Having lots of things makes it more complicated, doesn't it? Even trying to keep it for later makes it more complicated. So this is life, and sometimes it is complicated, and yet perhaps also maybe not so. I'd like to reflect and explore on some of the themes and areas of interest that you may have been touching on during your time here today and perhaps yesterday also. And yes, anyone who's having difficulty hearing, if you still are, please feel free to come forward. There are more spaces, and you're welcome to be at the back as well. So it's quite a full day to follow the schedule, to practice as we've been doing. It can seem like there's sometimes rather a lot in just a relatively short period of time. Sometimes there's a lot of what we like, what we enjoy, perhaps quiet, stillness, space, peace, sense of connection. Sometimes there can be what seems like a lot of what we don't enjoy. Discomfort, boredom, heat, restlessness, pointless activity, repeated again and again. And it's kind of interesting and useful to reflect on, well, what are we doing here? Why are we doing it? Even if this is something that's very familiar to you, that you've done many times before, and certainly if this is new. What are we doing? Why are we doing? Or what? Why are we engaging with ourselves, with our life, with this practice in this way? Another way we could put that is, what does it mean to receive our life? Much of what we're doing here is really just asking you in a very simple and direct way, in terms of what we're doing at the front, saying, receive your life. Let it in. Let it come to you. Don't move away. Don't flinch. Don't avoid. Don't go looking for something else. We haven't said that in so many words, but in essence, that's what's being invited in the meditation practice. This process of turning towards where we are, towards what's happening, towards what's actually here, is a response to recognizing that much of the time we're turning away, we're pulling away, we're disconnecting, we're resisting, or we're somewhere trying to reorganize what's going on in such a way that it might better fit with what we wish or prefer or think should be happening. And we get lost in that process so easily. The great teacher in Thailand, Ajahn Buddhadasa, who lived in the last century, and a very much loved and appreciated teacher, he was once asked, how would you describe the world? And he responded in just three words, with great precision and accuracy. He said, lost in thought. And I wonder if this is a description of the world or our life that we might at times relate to. Probably all of us here, whether beginners or experienced and well-practiced meditators, spent some of today lost in thought. I mean, anyone want to put their hands up to say they didn't? I certainly couldn't. And if I was to say, a little bit easy, put your hands up if you spent some time lost in thought today. The only person who might not put their hand up is someone who hasn't practiced meditation. Not because you get lost in thought because of meditation, but because you start to notice when you meditate just how much you are lost in thought. And of course, this sometimes seems like rather bad news and kind of disheartening. It's like, oh my gosh, here am I trying to be present, and look how strongly and how quickly and how insistently my mind pulls away towards this, that, the other thing. And yet it's actually good news that you start to see this more clearly. Just notice if I sit up more straight, it's too far away, and I'm sort of having to do this. So tell me, is that still okay? Yeah, we notice how much the mind pulls. We feel the insistence, the strength. And sometimes we also think, well, gosh, here am I, I'm trying to be mindful. Why is this happening to me? You know? But if we've spent much of our life, and most of us have, just letting the mind do what it does, then it doesn't just change, it doesn't just stop, it doesn't shift in a moment or an instant just because we'd rather like it to, so we could have a good meditation experience or succeed at this rather quaint or unusual practice, or however we see it. So we encounter, what we encounter here is our life. We, you know, people talk about the real life as being what goes on out there. It's not. This is real. That's real too, but mostly we're not in contact with that which is real about it, because we're busy being somewhere else. As we start to make the effort, and it requires some effort, some commitment, as we start to give ourselves to what it means to be here, we start to sense or notice, perhaps in small ways, perhaps we don't even realize we're doing it, but we start to come into contact with that which is real. Certainly more real than the world of fantasy and distractedness and reactivity that we easily inhabit and call our life or our home. Despite the fact that we never seem to come to a place of ease or rest or really find ourselves able to be at home in that world, because it has a drivenness to it, it has a sort of an unease to it, it has a sense of lack or a sense of urgency or a sense of struggle or confusion or frustration to it. And we know these things, we experience them, we recognize them. Often we think that's because I'm just not trying hard enough at what I'm supposed to do, and if I did more work or watched more movies, then it would be better. Or whatever it is, we think we need to be doing more or better. But really it's about a shift in our orientation to life. Somehow, rather than looking to get something from it according to what we imagine we are entitled to or would prefer, see, what can we give to this? What can we give to this life? And we're being asked here, when we talk about receiving our life, we're not saying, you know, sit back and receive. We're saying, give attention, give care, give interest, give energy in making an effort to be here. It's an offering we're making. It's not always that we get back from it what we'd like to, directly or immediately, and sometimes not at all. But we do get back what we need from this life, if we can start to see and understand how that works. So we're letting it in more fully by being present. What we start to see as we do that is there's a really good reason. It's not a random thing that we don't spend that much time being conscious and awake, and we spend so much time being lost in thought. There's a really good reason for that, because often it's quite uncomfortable to encounter it directly, to not kind of varnish it or sort of try and smooth it and soften it or shift it only towards the nice things and that. We try and do that because of how it is. That's challenging at times for us. That's not always easy to receive. And yet, so far as we're in that process or that drivenness, that busyness, that rush, that hurriness or hurriedness, believing that there's something to get or somewhere to go or someone else we need to become in order to be happy, in order to be free, in order to discover or to realize or to receive what it is that life truly has to offer us, because it does have an immense amount to offer. That rather than somehow needing to get somewhere else or do something else or produce more or become someone different, really what we are asked to do, what we need to understand here, is that we're asked and required, in fact, to come fully into conscious contact with what is true, what is real, what is actual, and what is here. And this simple reorientation, or in a way, it's not like we're going somewhere, but we're turning on the spot. So rather than looking out towards what isn't in order to somehow get it or get there, we're turning towards what is in order to be here, in order to be in this, and to come to understand what that is, what this is, to be alive. And sometimes we can hear thoughts and reflections such as this, or teachings such as this, and there could be a sense of inspiration and like, wow, yeah, I'm up for it, that's what I'm here for. And of course, you know, you didn't choose to spend this week going to a sort of a beach resort and lying by the sea. You know, you might have had a couple of thoughts today about wondering whether that was such a smart choice. You know, you might think, oh my gosh, here am I doing absolutely nothing for, you know, absolutely no effect, it seems. It's pointless, it's boring, the food's good, that's true, but, you know. And yet you didn't, of course, you didn't choose that. You chose to bring yourself into this situation. And despite, again, the fact that questions might arise, you have chosen to stay here. You might think, well, I had no choice, you know. My ride doesn't leave for another 5 days. But if one had to go, one would go. And so just to realize that you're actually a participant in what's here. You've given yourself, you've brought yourself to this. And there are greater and deeper degrees to which we can learn to bring ourselves to this, or to give ourselves to this. And this is one way we could describe the journey of our lives, equally as the journey of a retreat. And of course, the inspiration that we might feel and the enthusiasm, or the, yes, I really want to do meditation, I want to learn, I want to understand, you know, what this might offer me, I don't know, but I'm excited, that may come with the freshness of doing something the first time. Or maybe maybe a real deep sense already in one's life from one's years perhaps of practice, that this is something I want to deepen, strengthen, and broaden in my life. And yet, we don't always know exactly how or in what way that will unfold. So we have that, we may have that sense of clarity, of purpose, of passion, and yet, it doesn't always sustain. The number of times we find ourselves sitting in the meditation hall, and it's like, you know, okay, I got my body here, but oh, it's heavy, and it's hot, and it's sort of tiredness, sleepiness, heaviness. It comes, doesn't it? It's like sometimes we'd really rather not be here, and the body finds a way, or the mind finds a way to slip out. Sometimes if we're tired, of course, it's because we need to rest. But as someone was saying today in the group, well, gosh, I went to bed just after 9 o'clock. Didn't need to get up till 6. That was a lot of sleep. And still I was tired during the day. And he was wondering, well, what's that about? Of course, we don't know. We can't, and we don't need to know for sure. But it certainly can be that for many of us, we live our lives in a way that we turn up on retreat and we're in debt to our life. We've been asking and demanding a lot more of ourselves, our system, our body, than it can sustain. And when we get here and suddenly those demands are to some degree released, it's like the system says, despite the meditation instruction, despite our spiritual aspiration, despite our encouragements to really connect and be present, the system says, whoa, we got a chance to stop here, let's do it. And it does. And sometimes that's what's going on, and it's okay, because it's needed. We need some rest sometimes. And it's also telling us something about our life. It's like saying, you're living in overdraft when that happens. And maybe we know, maybe the last few weeks of our life were particularly busy, and it makes sense that it's so. But maybe it's that this is how we live our life. And it's not the last few weeks, it's the last few years, the last few decades. And if you're like me, you've probably been saying for those weeks or months or decades, soon I'll slow down, do less, take care of all of this. But so easily we don't. And we come somewhere and there's an opportunity to stop. And sometimes what happens in the stopping, it's like, it's not just we stop all the doing, but consciousness itself starts to grind to a halt. And it's that heavy, thick, dull, and it's really unpleasant. Have you noticed how unpleasant it is to feel tired and heavy and dull when you're supposed to be bright and alert and mindful of the subtle vibrations of your breath as it moves through your chest? It's really, it's like this fog. But of course it's not unpleasant, that experience. That heavy, thick, dull sensation isn't unpleasant, because you try it lying down in bed with a mattress comfortable in a blanket or a sheet and it's time to sleep, and that soft, heavy, dull feeling won't come. It's hell, isn't it? It's like, where's that feeling? I want it now. It's all to do with whether it's turned up in the right place for us, isn't it? And that really bright, clear, calm, focused attention, if that turns up at 11:30 when we want to go to bed, 9:30 on a retreat, it's like, hey, just a moment, no, go away, I want to sleep now. So it's like often the experience doesn't seem to fit with what we had planned for the moment, and there's a certain humility required of us to see, yeah, we're not in charge of that, we can't make it happen according to our plan. So sometimes we're bright and clear and still and steady on the cushion, sometimes that happens in the middle of the night. And likewise, sometimes we go to sleep quite easily on our mattress and sometimes quite easily on the pillow. And I mean, I call this a cushion, but some people call them a pillow. And I think that might be because occasionally you need to pick it up and, you know, put it under here. I'm not sure it's a good idea to think of it as a pillow, though, because it sort of encourages that thing. And yet, how can we respond to the fact of something as natural, ordinary and human as tiredness? That question might be, you know, do I need to consider what this means about my life? The question might be also, because it's not always that we're tired. Sometimes, and day one, pretty reliably, it's often to do with tiredness. But if it goes on for 2 days, 3 days, 4 days, it might be something else. It might not be so much that we're tired as that this is an escape route the mind has got for getting away from how it is to be where we are. Because part of what a retreat is something in which we choose consciously to reduce or remove many of our normal escape routes, many of the ways we avoid receiving our life, facing, meeting, experiencing, being touched by it. And so we don't have so many options. We don't have a refrigerator stocked full of, you know, pleasant, entertaining sensations in the mouth, which is what that is a lot of the time. It's not food, it's not nourishment for our well-being. It's pleasant, entertaining sensations in the mouth. I like them too. I have them as well. But when we use them in that way, we easily stay distant. So the food's out of our control here. It's lovely when it comes, but sometimes it's not there when we want it. Like at 9 o'clock, we might think, I'd like to have a snack, but there isn't one. Well, I think there might have been one last night, wasn't there? Was there one last night? Something offered? Or was it the first night? Yeah, it was the end of the first night, was it? No? Maybe not. Sorry. I saw someone eating something at 9 o'clock or so last night. Well, maybe they served something and I wasn't there. So then I thought, oh, maybe they'll serve something tonight. Maybe I should be there. I've just been disappointed. It does happen sometimes on retreats, but maybe it won't. But can we meet those kind of conditions or experiences where we're not turning up the way we wished or expected or hoped to? What can we meet that with? Can we bring a sense of, okay, what can I do here to be awake? Like, you know, we explored a bit lifting our arms up. That's quite challenging. It's really hard work sometimes, I find. And yet we can also hear stories, and I'm inspired by the story of a teacher of one of my friends, Martine Batchelor, who's a practiced in the Korean Zen tradition for 10 years, and her master, Master Kusan, once in his book that she translated, he describes how he went to do a 7-day retreat, and he was so tired he could just not stay awake at all. And he was wanting to do this retreat to generate goodwill and well-being for a friend of his who was sick and dying. So he was very deeply committed to his practice. And after a half a day of falling asleep, he said, "Okay, I'm going to stand on tiptoes for the rest of the retreat." And he did. Now, you can't really hurt your body standing on tiptoes. It's not going to, you know, break anything. But by gosh, it would be hard work. I'm not suggesting anyone here needs to do that. You'll be glad to hear, I expect. But something in the passion or the commitment or the willingness to give oneself in such a way, for him that was a useful response. For us it might be just sitting up straight or lifting the arms. But there's a way in which we engage with what's here, receiving and responding to it, engaging with it. And there's lots of opportunities for that here. We encounter the experience of discomfort in our bodies. You know, sometimes it hurts to be sitting still. And we might think it's, you know, we're not supposed to be sitting in these funny cross-legged positions, but actually if you talk to people who sit on chairs, and people do, and it's fine to do so, that can be uncomfortable too. One of the aspects of human life that we keep seeking to avoid, and that here we're asked to meet and experience, is that sometimes it's uncomfortable and painful. And you know, if you take a really comfortable mattress and you lie on it and you really don't move, after a little while you'll be uncomfortable. You know? If you really don't move, you get uncomfortable, even on the most expensive mattress. And if you stay there long enough, and this happens sadly and tragically to old people, if you stay there long enough and they can't move, also for other reasons too, but if you stay long enough, the skin starts to break down. You get bed sores. You know what this is? It's really a tough condition for people who are ill or very elderly. And so it's like the body doesn't do well when it doesn't move. Now, don't worry, you're not at risk of getting bed sores from sitting for 45 minutes. That's, I think, unheard of. Not in the realm of what we're risking here. But I'm more saying that to point out or suggest that the experience of discomfort is in the nature of the body, and that the way we deal with that often is by keeping moving. The Buddha said, and very interestingly and profoundly, he said, the pain of the body is disguised by the postures. You might wonder, what does he mean by that? As I understand it, it means that the changing of our postures is the way we avoid feeling the pain of the body. So when we sit and we don't move, we feel at different times, maybe our knee, maybe our shoulder, our back, maybe something to do with how we're sitting, like my ankle, maybe back of the head that's not part of that. We feel it, and we don't so quickly, and we certainly can't so easily move away from it without realizing that that's what we're doing. So there's something useful in this encounter with that aspect of our experience. Not because somehow we're supposed to have more pain and it's good for us, that's not really what that's about. But seeing that if we're constantly moving away from anything that's uncomfortable to us, and that's not just physical discomfort, but anything that might be slightly scary to us, which is that form of emotional or psychological discomfort, what happens is we're moving away. But wherever we move to, it's like, you know, you try, you sit, it's uncomfortable, oh, my leg hurts here, okay, I'll put it here. You put it here, oh, what a relief, phew, ah, I feel much better. 10 minutes later, oh no, it hurts. Okay, you know, we can be moving it around. We move, you know, hurts a bit here, I'll move this way, then it hurts here. What we do with our body on a cushion is often what we do with our life. We're constantly moving. It's not quite comfortable here, maybe it's comfortable there, great, good for a moment. Oh, now I need to move again. And what happens is Am I speaking too quickly? Okay, I just noticed it was speeding up. What happens is, I get excited, sorry. What happens is that by constantly moving, we start to build a momentum of movement, that we're constantly moving away from one thing in the hope that the next thing is going to be a place we can rest. But when we get there, there's a moment of, I can rest here, and then, oh no, I can't, and we move again. And what we arrive here with, most of us, is a body and a mind that's in the habit of moving, in the hope of coming to rest, but not having done so. Because that process doesn't ever come to an end. We never come to rest through moving away from where we are. There isn't a place we'll get to, because no matter where we get to, eventually it'll turn out to give us the same reason. And every time we move, we strengthen the habit and the tendency to keep moving. So not surprising we find our bodies are struggle to sit still, and they do for many. And for everyone, in fact, if one is new, maybe in 5 or 10 minutes the body feels uncomfortable. If you've done this 20 years or more, and some of us here have, you sit here long enough, your body gets uncomfortable. It just takes a bit longer before that happens. And if you keep sitting, it gets restless. For some great master, it might take them all day before that happens. But it still happens. And it's not actually any different in experience. Not just the body, of course, the mind struggles with being still. The activity we encounter, the movement, the busyness, is an expression of this principle that we notice more obviously in our body. But as we start to see what's going on with our mind, we start to see that too. That the mind is moving, looking for a place it can be at rest, looking to resolve or sort out or fix all the things that the mind thinks prevent it from resting. That once it's sorted out or fixed, it will be able to rest, but it never does. It never does, coming from that attitude, because it simply gets faster and faster and faster and faster. And we come here and we realize how painful it is to live in a body and mind that are spinning. And it takes an immense amount of heart and courage and goodness to say, I'm going to sit here with this. And I'm not going to keep feeding that momentum. I'm not going to keep spinning that wheel. And just like, you know, in the old days when flour was ground with a mill wheel, and there's a big stone wheel. It takes a lot to get it spinning, and you have to work at it. But once it gets spinning, it just, and we call it a flywheel, I think, or a mill wheel. It just spins and spins and spins. It's like that with the mind. We have to kind of just step back from it, give it space, and let its momentum discharge. It's like with a big stone wheel spinning. If you try and grab it to stop it, you'll lose the skin from your fingers. If with your mind spinning, you try and grab it and stop it, you'll experience the same kind of thing on the inside. It's like a friction on the inside where the movement of the mind rubs against the resistance saying, stop, stop, stop this mind. So we're not trying to stop it in that way. We're ceasing or learning what it means to no longer drive it, no longer feed that momentum, no longer spin the wheel. And so when we encounter discomfort, to see if we can bring kindness to this experience. It's like, this isn't easy, but all of us in life encounter it. The time of our birth, times of illness, the process of aging, the time of death. For most of us, this involves discomfort or pain. And seeing if we can open to that, open our heart to it as part of our life. Because it's very easy to come here with a sense that I'm trying to get my mind to be calm and quiet and still. And if it would do that, then I'd be happy. I'd feel like I've succeeded, and I'd go home with a nice certificate to say I could do it. We don't provide certificates. Sorry. But the bonus is you also can't fail. So we can think in terms of that, and we get excited because this is something we can do or achieve or perform at, we hope. And we're so used to living in that way of achieving, performing. But we can't do it sometimes because our body's restless or drowsy or in pain, or the mind is restless or drowsy or in pain. And in those moments, or in those times, because it may be more than moments, what we're being asked to is open our heart. We're not so much working on that developing of steadying and focusing the mind, which is part of what we're doing here. And it's a little bit easier and more obvious how we can measure that. You know, one breath, two breaths, three breaths, yeah, I'm doing okay. You know, someone says, sometimes people, of course, they say, oh, I can only stay present for two breaths, you know, it's hopeless, I'm getting nowhere. The person beside them thinks, two whole breaths, you know, it's like amazing. So it's all, those kind of measurements are all completely relative. But with this quality of heart opening, we can't measure it. There is no measurement that says it's open, it's closed. It's never closed. And if your heart is closed, you're dead. And it can always be more open. It can always be more open. And so we're seeing where it's less open than it could be. And those are the places where we say, no, I don't want this. And so we can start to actually inhabit our life more fully. That one aspect of it, of dealing with the difficult, we have to open our heart. We have to let it in. This life that's our experience, that's our truth. We can also see we work at times with pleasant experiences, how the sense of wanting something is so strong for us, how that we might hear and agree with what's just been said about clearly you can't, you know, trying to get more things just keeps you busier and busier. And yet in us this very strong pull to get what we want, to have what we think will fulfill us. And how that affects us is profound and actually tragic. There's a simple expression or illustration of it. One of the foods that I really love is lasagna. It's not a traditional Hebrew dish or Israeli dish, I don't think. But probably you're familiar with it. You know the cartoon Garfield? He eats a lot of it. It's made with pasta and sauce. And anyway, I like it a lot. I usually don't mention it this on retreats because then the cooks feel somehow that they have to make it for me. But here it's probably very unlikely, so it's safe, I think. I can't actually eat it these days because I can't eat anyway. So anyway, it's too much story. But what I meant to say, or maybe just the right amount of story, what I meant to say, this: what happened for me one time on a retreat was they served lasagna. And this was before I knew I shouldn't really eat wheat because it makes me fall asleep. So lasagna, it's like standing in the queue, seeing it there, it's like, you know, how big a piece can I take and still feel like I'm being moderate, restrained and holy, you know? And it's like, okay. So getting there, and you see this urge, it's like, so I took a really big portion, take it, and then as I start eating it, I'm thinking, oh, it's not that big a portion, maybe I can have seconds. And so as soon as I've got this thing, and I love this stuff, and it was a good one, I'm shoveling it into my mouth, like, and I'm thinking, will there be enough seconds, will there be enough seconds, will I get there? I didn't really enjoy the lasagna. I didn't actually really even know that I was eating it. I was just stuffing it in. By the time I finished, I was so full, I didn't want any more. It didn't really matter whether there were seconds. But that process whereby that sense of need and want and give me, often that dominates our experience, even when we have what we're looking for, to the extent that we can't enjoy it. We can't receive it. I could have really enjoyed that lasagna. It was tragedy. Tragedy. Worthy of Shakespeare, you know? Here's a man, he's given exactly what he wants. He does with it exactly what he wants to do with it. I eat it. And the whole experience is wasted. And I'm not so different than anybody else in that. We do that too. How long can we enjoy something before we worry about how long we can keep it? Or whether we can get some more? Most of us, not very long, you know? Have you noticed? We're sitting here struggling, we're drowsy, it's uncomfortable, God, we can't meditate. Ah, everybody else seems to be able to, which is another strange thing I'll maybe touch on. But you know, and then somehow it's like we give up on the whole struggle, and it's like, oh, and there we are, we're here. So, ah, my breath, oh, it's flowing in. Oh, yeah, it does go into my chest, to my belly. He was right. That was true. I can feel it. I can do it. It's great. I wonder how, maybe this means now I can be a real meditator, and maybe I'll go on a month's retreat, and then I could become a nun or a monk. And we're a long way from our breath. Blown it, messed up, hopeless. It's like we try and get hold of it, we try and keep it, but we can't. And then, of course, sometimes then we kind of collapse and give up, and it's... And sometimes in the letting go, in the giving up, we again just, oh, I'm here. Feeling a bit miserable, hopeless. Okay, that's what's happening. Maybe that's all right. Maybe that's allowed. I didn't say it wasn't allowed. We didn't say it's not allowed. So it's allowed, you're right. So there's this invitation to receive what comes and to let go. And at the same time, we're engaged in a form and a practice and a mode of exploring. And sometimes it seems a little silly. Did anybody have the thought during the walking meditation, what are we doing? Or what are they doing? Because I'm not doing that. That looks pretty seriously like some, you know, some kind of diagnosable condition. Maybe we need some psychiatric help here. And yeah, from a conventional point of view, it probably looks pretty strange. Occasionally people wander through the grounds who aren't on the retreat, and they look around and one wonders what they make of it. But, you know, in most retreats here, it's kind of contained within the grounds and that. But in other places I go where there isn't a fence, you know, we usually say, don't do the walking meditation outside the grounds, because other people get really worried. You know, sometimes they get scared, sometimes they get angry to see someone walking like that. Of course, I don't know if you've ever seen those overhead shots of what goes on in the middle of a city at rush hour. Have you ever seen a film of an overhead shot of all the people moving to or from work at 8:30, whenever it is? You know, you could put it beside an ant colony, and it would... Actually, the ants colony looks like it makes more sense. But it's like just crazy chaos going on, and we call that normal. So here we're doing something like walking meditation. We're not getting really quiet and calm and meditative. It doesn't feel particularly spiritual or profound, but we're doing it. And there's a lot to it, but the piece I want to touch on here is that it's actually really useful to do something that's pointless. From the point of view of our normal idea of what makes sense, i.e. getting busy doing something, getting somewhere, producing something, succeeding, getting acclaim and affirmation for having succeeded, all of that tends to fill up most of our lives. And in the walking meditation, there's not much on offer. Pointless. It's not achieving anything. We're not getting anywhere. Nobody has noticed how good we're walking. Why should I do this? And it brings us up against the whole way in which we rely on getting feedback and input from the world and from others to tell me I'm okay, to tell me I'm doing all right, to tell me that I'm good, or I'm valuable, that I'm precious, that I'm beautiful, that I'm lovable, that I'm acceptable, that they're not going to attack me or kill me. We rely on our activity to try and produce that response from the world and from others to tell us I'm okay and that I'm safe. But it's founded on a sense that somehow I'm not. Otherwise we wouldn't need to be doing that to prove it to ourselves. And as the more we're doing it, the more we're reinforcing the sense that it's not okay, that we're not okay, that something is wrong and has to be fixed about me. Which is part of why it keeps on and on. No matter how good you do at something, how successful you are, who gets to stop there and say, huh, that's enough. No, if we have to do that, then we have to do it some more. And we have to keep doing it. And it doesn't matter if we were really good before. If we're bad now, we're bad. Does that make sense? I mean, it's, in some ways I'm expressing it in a little simplistic language, but often that's where it goes. Just, am I okay? So if we're not doing something to make ourselves okay, we're not reinforcing the belief that we're not. We might feel the uncomfortableness of that belief, the fact that we don't quite know who we are here, or what we're supposed to be doing. And that's uncomfortable, but it's important. In fact, it's more than important, it's crucial. Do we allow ourselves to begin to explore the uncomfortable unfamiliarness of not really knowing what we're doing and how we're doing it in terms of any ultimate significance? Of course, important to know that, you know, in the walking meditation it's good to put one foot in front of the other, or, you know, with, I don't know if you've heard of Tofu Roshi, a great Zen master, in cartoon form. And anyway, he said once it's really important that you have the same number of in-breaths as out-breaths. And you really need to make sure that happens, or else big trouble. So certain things, yeah, we need to know what we're doing here. But in terms of what's happening, we don't need to know it in advance. But if we can meet it, if we can open to it and receive it as it comes, then so much is possible here for you, for us. So this quality of being interested, of being open, we have to consciously let go. To support that, we have to let go of our sense of knowing what's going to happen. Because as soon as something happens, we tend to think, and particularly if it's difficult, the way the mind moves, as it says, I'm feeling a bit bored now. I don't mind a bit of boredom for one or two sittings, but what if it happens the whole day? What if it goes on all of tomorrow? Well, a whole week of being bored sounds horrible. I couldn't do that. And it's the mind thinking about something that's just happening now, projecting it into the future, and then feeling overwhelmed by what is essentially a fabrication. Because it's not going to happen all day or all week. Nothing stays that steady or consistent. Things change. And yet we tend to react to them as if they would not change. So there's a way in which we just come back to here, come back to now, come back to this. It's not always fun, it's not always beautiful, but it's real. And there's something in that realness that can begin to speak to us. Because there's something in us that knows that language. But it's a quieter language. It's not so much loud. It's not so much shouting. But we recognize it. We know it when it speaks to us. But we need to be a little quieter to hear and to support it. And one of the qualities, as I said, that enables that is a sense of curiousness. Just that we're not here somehow without our sense of interest in the world. Of course we are here. But we're not trying to express that interest in the world by trying to think about it or figure it out, or figure out where it's going, which is how that interest is often expressed, through mental activity. We're trying to express that interest by our willingness to see what's here, to look again, what's this, what's now. And you know, a sense of interest in that way is something very beautiful and powerful about it. Like a child encountering for the first time an insect that they've never seen. It's like these big eyes of wow, and fascinated with something alive. You know, we might think we know who and what we are, but there's a way in which we could encounter this with that fascination of wow, look at this, it's alive. Look what it's doing. Look how it shows up. Sometimes like this, sometimes like that. You know, could we look at this life, at this moment, at ourselves with that sense, that spirit? Often often what makes it really hard to do that is a sense that we need to know what to do and how to do it in order to get it right. We've got to get it right. We're not allowed to get it wrong. Mistakes are not okay. Especially now that we're adults and grown up and mature and intelligent. Mistakes are embarrassing, humiliating, and evidence that we're stupid. That's what we get told. It's one of the greatest lies in the world. Anyone who isn't making mistakes is staying within a safety zone of comfort that easily ends up being dead. The only way we learn is to go out into the territory of what we don't know. It's obvious. And where we don't know, of course we don't get it right the first time. Of course we don't. There's that expression in English, I don't know if you have an equivalent, that says, curiosity killed the cat. The horror of that expression is not that it isn't true, not that it isn't true, I love cats. It's not that it isn't true, because it can do. But that the whole expression is this, curiosity killed the cat, and then the cat came back. And that bit doesn't get quoted so often. What does that mean? Curiosity killed the cat, and then the cat came back. Different feeling, huh? Sounds like it's a little scary to go into that unknown territory, and we might risk something, but we might discover something too. And yet the sense of having to get it right, to know how it is. You know, we so quickly set up models and ideas of how it should be, how it must be, because they make us feel safe. It happens here. Within moments of getting here, we start looking around, figuring out how to do it right, because then we'll be okay and feel safe. One of the great blessings of being new here is that you haven't figured it out yet. Don't rush getting to the point where you have, because there's a grace and a potency in that time that once you have figured out how to get it right, and there's plenty of people here who also have done that, you then have to work really hard to undo what your mind has done in that process of thinking it knows how to get it right. And just as a simple expression of this, and I haven't been looking and I don't know, but I find if I sit up here, and I imagine, same for any other teacher, it's not about me, if I sit here and I put my hands here, and I do it every sitting, you see, on the ends of my knees, by the end of the day, most of the people have got their hands here. If I put them here, and I don't say anything about my hands when I talk about posture, if I put them here, by the end of the day, much higher proportion of people have them here. Probably no one thinks about it. Man, he's been doing this a while, that's probably what you're supposed to do. That must be right. I'll do it. Boom. And it doesn't even go through our conscious mind, it just happens. So I tend to alternate. Both in my own practice, but when I'm sitting up here, because I'm not trying to suggest you should do it this way or this way. I'm trying to sit up straight most of the time because I am trying to suggest that, but I don't always succeed. And so there's a sense to see, you know, can we let ourselves not get it right? Can we not have to make those kind of institutions so quickly? This morning in the first sitting before breakfast, and most of you were here, a cat came in. Very sweet. It walked in, meow, meow, meow. It's very, you know, like a metronome for music. You know, meow, 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 meow. It was like clockwork. And it sat down, licked itself for a little while, and sort of rasping noises, and then it got up and meow, meow, meow. And it's like interesting. It reminded me of the story about a teacher who at the center there was a cat, and it would always come in, and when people were practicing it would make noise and cause trouble, so they'd tie it up. And then after some years they tied the cat up so it wouldn't do that. Then after some years, many years later, the teacher had died and there was a new teacher, but the cat died, so they got another one so they could tie it up. They start to think this is what you have to do to practice. Religions are full of this. And we're doing it here already, probably. It's so easy. We look, someone walking very quickly during the walking, what are they doing? Somewhere else you go and people walking too slow in the walking, what are they doing? walking. And we do it to ourselves most. So give yourself permission to not know how to do it or get it right. Certainly not too quickly. Learning is what we're here for. And learning happens in only one way. And another story of a great teacher who was much loved by his students, and one student who lived far away had the opportunity to meet with his teacher for the first time for a private interview. Very special. He was going to be able to ask the questions. And he was like, oh, I'm so excited. So he came along and he bowed in front of the teacher and he says, oh, teacher, please tell me, what is the most important thing to cultivate? Teacher looks at him. Good judgment. Oh, thank you. Yeah, good judgment. Yeah, I understand. How do you cultivate good judgment?
Experience.
Oh, yeah, of course, experience. How do you get experience?
Bad judgment.
So you really can't lose if you take it in that spirit. We're here to learn what it means to be awake, and also to learn why it is that that's not an easy thing to undertake. And all of it is part of that. All of it is part of that. How we come to be where we are is a complicated and remarkable process. We don't need to figure out the details of how we got here. But to really receive your life as it is, we're asked to turn towards what it is as it is, again and again and again. To not compare it with another's, or a different one that we wished we would have had or should have had. To really trust what we do have, because this is what is real. To be gentle with yourself, wholehearted and committed, and also gentle. I had this image, and bearing in mind I've been talking for a wee while, if you need to change your posture, you're allowed to while I'm talking. I'll be just a few more minutes. I had this image as I was reflecting before coming to speak about what it means to receive our life, receive my life, and some hearing of the story of Iran receiving some lives with his partner and babies. And I think he already spoke about it, so I hope I'm not giving the information away, but if he didn't, then I have. But I was very touched hearing the sense of receiving a life, lives. And reflecting on what that is, how we receive a life like that. I'm not a parent, so that hasn't happened for me in that way exactly. But at Rosh Hashanah and the meal with my family that I had, and two of my cousins had daughters since I was last here, aged sort of between 2 and 3, Maya and Sophie. And the first one, Maya, I met her. She looks at me, she jumps on me, we cuddle, we play, we run about, she won't leave me alone, I love it. And it's like, wow, how lovely. The other one, she looks again, she goes back to mum. She doesn't have much to do or much to say to me. By the end of the day, she's really upset, and I give her a little something, and with some encouragement from her mother and her father, she comes and gives me a little shy hug on the leg. I think, wow, she's doing great. And I think, these little girls, they're just about the same age, they're completely different in some ways. In other ways. But it's like, one doesn't look and say, oh, this one should be like that one, or that one should be like this one. It's like, this is how they came. This is lovely, and that's lovely. And how you came is lovely. still is lovely. Really, it is. But we don't always let ourselves see that. And yet, even if we can't see it, what about if we were to receive it as if it were? Of course, those little girls got upset, one of them. Crying, screaming. Didn't look lovely. But it was still lovely because it was free and it was true. And it changed. So we too have our hard places, but they change. So, really, my invitation again, and maybe saying in more words what has already been said in less, and will be said again, really be here for this. Whatever happens in this journey is what it's supposed to be. If you're willing to take it in that spirit, there are no limits to what is possible here. So let's just sit quietly for a moment or two together. So may we all, through our practice here and in our lives, find the courage of heart to receive the loveliness and the challenge of the life that we are, just as we are. For our welfare and for the welfare of all beings. Thank you for staying with that. I really didn't plan to speak for so long. I have to try and not get so excited next time. But it's time for some walking now, and since it's a little later than scheduled, perhaps if the bell would ring at 10 minutes to 9, and then the sitting beginning at 5 minutes to. Is the bell ringer here? Thank you. Okay? And then we have the last sitting of the evening together till about 9:20.